Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
How did it come about?
Let's have a bit of history.
It is not black and white, is it?
That raises big questions.
There are repercussions around the world.
It's a hugely complicated picture.
The official narrative is somewhat different.
For a greater understanding of the stories affecting our lives, search for The Explanation wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Janet Jalil at 13 hours GMT on Wednesday the 15th of May. These are our main stories. As Ukrainian forces struggle to hold back Russian advances on several fronts and President Zelensky cancels planned trips abroad, the US announces a further $2 billion in military aid. Prison officers in France hold protests after five of their colleagues are left dead or wounded in an ambush involving heavy weapons. A new study suggests millions of middle-aged people may mistakenly think they're not obese because of the way they calculate their body fat. Also in this podcast, American music legend Stevie Wonder is granted Ghanaian citizenship.
To celebrate the greatness of Africa, I'm just very, very honoured.
As Ukrainian forces try to hold back Russian onslaughts at several different points on their sprawling front line, America's top diplomat has announced a further military aid package. This comes as President Zelensky has cancelled upcoming international trips, including visits to allies Spain and Portugal, reportedly because of the worsening situation on the battlefield. A week after Russia's surprise attack on the northeastern Kharkiv region, Ukraine has pulled back troops from some border regions, but at the same time it's insisting it will not allow the Russian occupiers to gain a foothold. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken, who's visiting Ukraine, announced the $2 billion of military aid at a news conference with his Ukrainian counterpart, Dmytro Kuleba.
Ukraine is facing this renewed brutal Russian onslaught, and we see, again, senseless strikes at civilians, residential buildings. We're rushing ammunition, armored vehicles, missiles, air defenses, rushing them to get to the front lines, to protect soldiers, to protect civilians. And on air defenses, as Dmytro said, this is, of course, a top priority. And we focused in our own conversations in detail on the work that we're doing to find more air defenses and to get them to Ukraine. And I can tell you that that, for us, is a matter both of urgency and priority.
This comes weeks after Washington finally approved a $61 billion military aid package after months of wrangling in the U.S. Congress. Our Ukraine correspondent, James Waterhouse, watched Mr. Blinken's news conference in Kyiv.
This feels like the substance to this two-day diplomatic visit. You firstly heard from Dmytro Kuleba reiterate Ukraine's wish list that air defence systems are top of the list. He's previously asked for seven of the actual launch systems used to launch these missiles. They cost about $1 billion each, and thus far Western allies have been reluctant to hand them over because of either cost or, in the case of Greece, they say they need them themselves. And this has been an issue brought into sharp focus with this Russian assault in northeastern Ukraine because of the city of Kharkiv now coming in, under increasing aerial attack by invading forces. So you had that reiteration from Dmytro Kuleba. You had that $2 billion package announced by Antony Blinken to kind of grease the wheels of this incoming American aid. And I think that's been his core message throughout, saying, look, we're going to get this to you as quickly as possible while Ukrainian forces continue to withdraw, it seems, in this northeastern Kharkiv region. And then was there perhaps a significant shift in policy or tone from Antony Blinken, where he was asked whether he would allow or relax the stipulation that Ukraine wasn't allowed to use missiles provided by the West on targets inside Russia. Until now, it's been agreed that won't happen, reluctantly on Kyiv's side, because of Western fears of an escalation by Russia in this war. Interestingly, Mr. Blinken there said, well, we've never encouraged that, but it's up for Ukraine to make those decisions. Was he perhaps loosening those restrictions around the use of Western missiles in that way. What is this attack in Kharkiv, Ben, is showing is Ukraine's struggle to defend this increasing front line, because the border area there is huge. And Ukraine has struck, yes, hit targets inside Russia, but only with drones and missiles it's manufactured domestically. Given that it's long been known that Russian troops have been gathering across the border, there are question marks over whether Ukraine was even able to prevent the incursion that is now 5 days in, 6 days in.
James Waterhouse in Kyiv. As we record this podcast, we're getting reports from Slovakia that the Prime Minister, Robert Fico, has been taken to hospital after being shot and wounded. One local news site said Mr. Fico was leaving a government meeting in the central town of Hanlovar when several shots were fired from a crowd. A witness said he fell to the ground and was then loaded into a vehicle and taken away. Our correspondent, Rob Cameron, has the latest.
So far, we believe that a total of four or five shots rang out as Robert Fico was emerging from that government meeting in the central town of Hanlovar. We believe two or three of those shots hit him. And the latest information that we have is that he was injured in the abdomen and possibly in the arm and the foot. Eyewitnesses, members of the crowd who were there to greet him, described seeing him falling to the ground and being lifted off the ground. He was said to have blood on him. But exactly how serious those injuries are, we don't know yet. So the hospital spokeswoman in the local town of Hanlovar said that he was conscious. He was being taken to a higher grade hospital. We believe that is Banská Bystrica, which is the nearest big city in Slovakia, and that he was receiving treatment in an intensive care unit for those injuries. But that's the information that we have on his condition so far.
And we'll bring you more on that story in a later edition of this podcast. In an earlier edition of this podcast, we brought you news of an ambush on a prison van in France that has shocked the nation. Two prison officers were killed and three others seriously wounded when a convicted prisoner with links to drugs gangs in the city of Marseille was freed. Video footage showed a car ploughing into the prison van and a gang of men wearing balaclavas then firing automatic rifles at the trapped officers before escaping with the inmate. Now prison officers are taking part in a nationwide protest, holding a minute's silence and blockading the gates of jails across the country. This man spoke for many as he took part in a protest outside a prison in northwestern France.
On n'aurait jamais pu croire.
We could never have believed what happened to us yesterday. I've been a prison officer for 35 years. I experienced something similar back in 1992, but this time it's far worse, because we didn't expect it. It was a commando unit who attacked the staff. Looking at the videos, it's clear that no one could have intervened and retaliated. It all happened so quickly.
A huge manhunt is underway with hundreds of police officers searching for the killers and the prisoner they freed. I got more from our correspondent Nick Beek outside the jail where the escaped convict was being held in Evreux in northwestern France.
This is the place where for the past month or so the prisoner Mohamed Amra had been held, and authorities have confirmed in the past few hours that actually earlier in the week he attempted to break out of this particular prison. They say that he tried in some way to saw through the bars of his jail cell. Now, clearly that was unsuccessful, but what happened yesterday was successful from his point of view and the point of view of the men who staged this brutal ambush in which two prison officers were killed. And that is why we've seen this grief today in many parts of France, people talking about the safety at work that they say that they're simply not getting. So there is this anger fused with grief today.
And prison officers are calling on the authorities to do more to protect them, because these five prison guards were armed, but their guns were no defence against this very heavy weaponry used by the attackers.
Yeah, and I think at the heart of this, what the prison officers are saying is that they're asked to do too many journeys. So in their eyes, they're making unnecessary trips either from prison to the courthouse or back again, when a lot of these hearings, they say, could be done over video, by video link-up. And they say they're being put in danger. Also, yeah, they talk about having a lack of weaponry to protect themselves. And you're absolutely right. The attackers yesterday had some really serious weapons, which reflects once again that criminal gangs in France can get hold of very, very powerful guns, but also that they're not, that they're prepared to use them not just on each other, but police officers or certainly people representing the state, security guards or prison staff. So there is a great deal of concern about this. All the while, this manhunt continues.
Nick Beek in France. Firefighters in Western Canada say more than 100 fires are now out of control. The wildfires have scorched tens of thousands of acres and are burning close to a number of large towns in Alberta and British Columbia. Thousands of residents have been told to evacuate as high winds are causing flames to move quickly. Marina Barnes left her home in Fort McMurray, a city in Canada's major oil-producing region, as thick smoke was filling the skies. She spoke to Victoria Uwankundo from an evacuation site, a hotel that was already full when she got there.
I haven't really processed, gotten a chance to process everything yet, because we're still kind of in limbo on where to go.
What were you able to take with you from your home when you evacuated?
Definitely the cats were first and foremost. We did have warning, so the evacuation alert came out on May 10th, so we've had a few days to be prepared. So I was able to bring all my important documents. I've got documents for the cats and the pets and stuff. And then, of course, we've got clothes, some non-perishable food items, just some other, you know, gaming stuff, some stuff that I thought I would want to take with me just in case, some expensive things.
How challenging has it been to move from place to place?
We're in the first spot now, and we have options. We've got friends reaching out to us in the area. We have traveled about 2.5 hours south of where we live. So we're waiting. I'm still waiting for the phone call. We had to register as an evacuee at this hotel we're at and then wait for a phone call from them to find out what to do. And we're still kind of waiting just to hear where we're supposed to go.
How many people are with you at the moment, or were you evacuated with?
I evacuated with one friend who lived around the corner from me, so he came and picked me up. And we've got a lizard, a dog, and two cats in the truck with us, and then our belongings.
When you were leaving, what was the conditions that you were seeing around you when you were evacuating from your home?
The roads were pretty much gridlocked once we got that evacuation order. People were panicking. The smoke clouds, the sky was orange. The smoke clouds were crazy. The roads were completely gridlocked. There was peace officers and police directing traffic right through the stoplights. And then as you were heading out of Fort McMurray, there was at least 10 to 12, maybe 15 massive sprinklers just dousing water all over the trees and the grass. There were helicopters flying all over, police driving up the wrong side of the highway, up the sides of the roads. There was a lot of people that we got out of Fort McMurray, and a lot of people had pulled over to the side of the road and turned around, and you see just this big, massive black cloud of smoke. You see the orange in the sky. It was terrifying to look back and see.
Marina Barnes speaking to Victoria Uwankundo. Let's turn now to Singapore. Where Lawrence Wong has been sworn in as the new prime minister. He becomes only the fourth leader of the Asian financial hub in its 59-year history. Our correspondent in Singapore, Nick Marsh, told us more about him and the challenges he faces.
Lawrence Wong is taking over from Lee Hsien Loong, who was in charge for 20 years. And like you said, he's only the fourth person to lead Singapore in its 59-year history. So Singaporeans aren't really used to this kind of transition of power. I mean, it's literally a once-in-a-generation event. And I was actually just watching the coverage. It's a pretty grand affair. There's about 1,000 people, grand presidential palace, military, lots of speeches, all that kind of thing. So it's not often a new prime minister comes around. In terms of the challenges that Lawrence Wong is going to face, I mean, the very fact that his surname isn't Lee, like his predecessor, or like his predecessor's father, Lee Kuan Yew, who was the founding father of Singapore, that's going to be difficult because, you know, the public, they don't really Maybe they don't consider him as coming from the same political royalty as the people who came before him, a little less credit in the bank. I think his main challenge, really, in terms of a foreign policy aspect, is to make sure Singapore is friends with both the US and China. And at home, he's got to call an election by the end of next year, which his party will certainly win. They always win. They've won every election since 1965. But the question is, by how much? And, you know, how much young Singaporeans are still maintaining faith with the People's Action Party, which has dominated Singapore for so long?
Nick Marsh. Now, are you one of those who've managed to avoid the dreaded middle age spread? If so, well done. But you may want to listen closely to the following story. Italian scientists say millions of middle-aged adults who believe they're a healthy weight may, in fact, be obese. The scientists reached this conclusion after they looked at people's body fat percentage instead of calculating their body mass index, or BMI, a measure that's commonly used to determine if people are overweight. Philippa Roxby is our health reporter and told us more about the study.
BMI, body mass index, is the standard way of measuring how healthy people are, whether they're healthy weight or overweight or obese. But it's quite a broad brush thing, and it doesn't know the difference between fat and muscle and bone. So if you're a very muscly person like a bodybuilder, you're seen to be obese when actually you might be quite fit. So these Italian researchers scanned thousands of people instead, looking at how much body fat was in somebody's body, a percentage. And they found out that they actually found a lot more people were obese than the standard method of finding out. And so they're warning that BMI on its own, you know, isn't really a great method. And we know that because previous studies have also said it's quite broad brush. It doesn't really work very well. So they're saying, you know, always think of other things you can do to find out if people are obese.
And they're saying that potentially there could be millions of people who think that they're not obese who actually are. And why is it important to find out if you're obese?
Well, obesity is a chronic disease, and it leads to all sorts of other health issues, like conditions like type 2 diabetes, and it ups your risk of heart disease and stroke, cardiovascular disease. So it's a major health issue. And we know that right around the world, globally, there's a huge increase in the number of people who are obese, particularly in Western countries. And in places like the USA, it's well over a third of people are obese. So there are huge health issues connected with it. So the closer we are to knowing exactly how many people really are obese, then the better it is for actually trying to help them.
So people listening to this, if they're worried, what can they do?
Well, I think this is acknowledging that as we age, and this is really about middle-aged people onwards, our bodies do change. And actually, we do tend to get a pile-up of body fat around the middle, and our muscle mass declines as well. And so our bodies are changing, and we have to maybe think about that as we age and maintain exercise, think about our diet a bit more closely, and be aware that our bodies are changing.
Good advice. That was Philippa Roxby. Still to come on this podcast.
Remember where you saw my glasses?
Yes, I do. Your glasses were on the desk near a red apple.
Tech giant Google's search engine gets an AI overhaul. Welcome back to the Global News Podcast. For years now, there have been questions about the safety of Boeing 737 MAX aircraft. This comes after two fatal crashes, one in 2018 in Indonesia and one in 2019 in Ethiopia. Those crashes killed a total of 346 people. Now the US Justice Department says that Boeing could face criminal charges after it determined the plane maker had not complied with the terms of an agreement to shield it from prosecution. The families of those who died have welcomed this development. Zipporah Kuria lost her father in the Ethiopian air crash.
For the first time, it feels like we're being listened to and we're being heard. I think when you lose a loved one in the way that we have, there's no form of prosecution or justice or anything like that that could ever suffice in terms of soothing that. But I think for us, the plight has been that for the public safety. And it's been clear that the more Boeing get away with, the more dangerous they are for the flying public. For us, this is finally a moment, what feels like has been a muffled scream for so long, is finally being heard. Obviously, we're not at outcome stage, but it feels like a step in the right direction.
As well as a three-year deal to avoid criminal prosecution, Boeing also paid $2.5 billion. Our business reporter, Monica Miller, told us more.
Federal investigators had filed a letter in a Texas court accusing Boeing of violating that 2021 deferred prosecution deal. And they were saying that the reason is they violated the terms of the settlement by failing to make promised changes to detect and prevent violations of a federal anti-fraud law. Now, this comes in the wake of a separate investigation that involves a January in-flight blowout of a door plug of a new 737 MAX 9 jet that had exposed safety as well as quality issues at Boeing. So right now, it is up to the Justice Department to decide whether to file charges against the airplane maker. Prosecutors will tell the court their decision no later by the 7th of July.
And this decision has been welcomed by the families of those who died in those two air crashes.
It has. I mean, this has been a long, painful battle, and the Justice Department has met with them a few times on this issue. Boeing has been in front of Congress answering questions as to what had happened. But, you know, what it really goes back to is after those fatal crashes, Boeing had reached, as you mentioned, a $2.5 billion settlement with the Justice Department in January 2021. And that was to avoid prosecution over one single charge of fraud that was misleading federal regulators who had approved the plane. Now, the airplane maker blamed the deception on two relatively low-level employees. Now, this deal was made, but it didn't have the backing of these family members who said that, you know, basically deny them any justice for the deaths of their loved ones.
And what's Boeing's reaction been to this?
Well, Boeing has come, you know, has basically denied it. They say that they will work with the Justice Department, but they believe that they had honored the terms of their agreement and that they said that they look forward again to the opportunity to respond to the department on this issue.
Monica Miller, there's already been massive civilian bloodshed in Sudan's civil war, which has been raging for more than a year. Now it appears the region of Darfur is on the brink of another disaster, two decades after the genocide there made international headlines. Fighting is intensifying around the city of El Fasher, the last city in the region not controlled by the paramilitary group the RSF, which is engaged in a power struggle with the army. Nearly a million people are trapped in El Fasher. Many have already been displaced by the conflict, and there are fears that if the RSF and its allied Arab militias do take the city, they'll carry out ethnically targeted killings and rapes. Kalkidan Yabeltel reports.
El Fasher has been a refuge for people fleeing violence in Sudan's Darfur region. Tens of thousands fled to the city when their villages came under attack from members of the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces, or RSF. The group has besieged the city for weeks, and on Friday, fighting intensified. The medical charity Doctors Without Borders was forced to close a pediatric hospital after an airstrike killed two children. Residents spoke of the continuous attacks.
While we were in our house and the situation outside was very turbulent, we heard a loud boom, dust rising and people screaming. We went outside to find an injured man and another who seemed to have died. Fear was in our hearts. We left the area and we walked a long distance on foot until we reached a safe area after too much suffering.
Sudan's year-long war is pitting the Sudanese army against the RSF as they battle for control of the country. The war has taken a heavy toll on civilians, with thousands killed and millions left homeless. Across the country, 25 million people are in dire need of humanitarian assistance. In recent weeks, relief agencies have been warning of a potential RSF offensive against El Fasher. Those who had been seeking refuge in the city are once again in the line of fire.
Because of the ongoing fighting between the ASF and the RSF, our last moments at home were filled with fear, horror, and chaos. We had to flee very quickly to get away from the escalating danger. The gunfire kept going and was constant to the point that bullets were flying through the house. I feel like this war is drawing impact on our souls before claiming us. It's leaving us with very deep and painful memories.
Both warring sides have been accused by the UN of gross rights violations. The RSF additionally are accused of targeting non-Arabs in Darfur, something that they deny. With no end in sight for the violence, the suffering of the Sudanese people continues.
That report by Calcidan Yubeltel. We heard in a previous podcast about the devastating floods in southern Brazil. Nearly 150 people are known to have died across Rio Grande do Sul state. 2 weeks after torrential rain started, the Guaíba River, running by the state capital Porto Alegre, is rising again, having passed the all-time high. We brought together residents Carlos Vinicius, Tasso Oliveira and Renata Padilla to tell us about how their lives have changed, starting with Renata on the moment she realised she'd lost her home.
As soon as I got to Porto Alegre, I saw my house with loads of water, so everything I had I lost due to this flood. For me, it was really shocking because I've never seen anything like that. At the same time, there were a lot of people being rescued. You can see in their eyes that they were really traumatized. You can see helicopters everywhere. You can see sounds of people screaming because they lost everything like in just a minute of their lives. Till right now, I can't do much. I just have to sit here where I am and wait for the water just to go down so I can go to my apartment and see what's left for me.
As Renata was saying, also, you want to help people, you want to be there. You're enabled by it, man, and you're saying, hey, I can do something. But also, I have an elderly mother, and that was a decision that I had to take, basically, right? If do I go out? Do I keep going out? Do I keep trying? Or do I just stay home and try to get them out of here? And the warning was issued first, and then they gave us the order to evacuate. As Renata said, to see the army going in and evacuating people from hospitals and stuff like that. So all that started really getting to me. My sister also lived in this streets nearby, and she had to evacuate completely because her apartment was in the first floor, and we had to go back there and get her cats. And she's not coming back to Porto Alegre. She decided that she's going to move away.
It's very interesting to hear like the story of Renata and Carlos, because my story is completely different. I live in Rio de Janeiro, but my entire family lives here in Santa Maria because I was in the military. I decided to go to the front and help the way I can. And one day I started to do some rescue because I work in social impact in Rio de Janeiro. I'm trying to create some connections between the organizations here and the organizations there. For example, here for like almost 5 days, we don't have a drinkable water. And for 3 days, we don't have electricity.
We were definitely not prepared. I see that the solidarity is everywhere. The feeling that I got from all of this is that we'll face it together.
I totally agree with Renata. Says like we see a lot of solidarity with some community kitchens who are giving like 1,000, 2,000, 5,000 food per day, like to give to the people who are in the shelter. So that is something beautiful.
Carlos, Renata and Tasso talking about how the floods in Brazil have affected them. Google was one of the first tech giants of the internet age. Its search engine is used by more than 2 billion people, but the emergence of artificial intelligence bots like ChatGPT have been viewed as a threat to Google's dominance. Now it's announced what it's calling the biggest changes to its search engine in 25 years.
So whatever's on your mind, whatever you need to get done, just ask. And Google will do the Googling for you.
Google's head of search there saying Google will be doing our Googling. So what does that mean exactly and how will it work? Nick Miles asked our technology editor, Zoe Kleinman.
This is Google coming out fighting. It's been accused of being a bit on the back foot in this AI race, which is really surprising because on paper, Google's got everything. It's got loads of money. It's got loads of expertise. It's been doing this for ages. It's well regarded. And yet so far, its AI products just haven't kept up with those big viral market leaders, you know, notably ChatGPT from OpenAI. But what we've seen is Google showing off the next generation of its products. And clearly these are Google demonstrations. So this is the company making its products look as good as they can possibly look, but they are a game changer. And what they show us is that if you're Siri or Alexa, you should be worried because this next generation is sort of gunning for that digital assistant market. And the difference is it can do so much more. So we're seeing AI go into all of Google's products, you know, making Gmail search more efficient, being able to specifically search through your endless photographs to find a picture of your car with its license plate. You know, it will be able to identify which car is your car from the collection of photos that it has of you with various cars. And the thing that I loved particularly was there was a demo of it using their smartphone camera to explore an office and pick out various things in this office. And at the end of the demo, the lady who was showing it said, "Where are my glasses?"
"Remember where you saw my glasses?"
"Yes, I do. Your glasses were on the desk near a red apple."
And it hadn't been asked that before. It didn't have to then specifically go and look for the glasses. It was just able to do it. Now, if like me, you lose your glasses all the time, yeah, this is a game changer, isn't it? But you can sort of see how this tech is trying to become not only super useful, but super useful in everyday life.
Zoe Kleinman there. Now,
seen a lot of things in this old world. When I touch them, they're nothing, girl. Ooh,
signed, sealed, delivered. American music legend Stevie Wonder has been granted Ghanaian citizenship. The star, now 74, has long been an admirer of the West African country. Our reporter Thomas Nardi sat down with him to hear how he feels about becoming a citizen of Ghana.
Through having dual citizenship and this being my home as well, I can just do great things with bringing our family together, to bringing African Americans and Americans and everyone together, to come together to celebrate how the greatness of Africa. So I'm just very, very honored.
Can you share any specific connections or experiences that have drawn you to this country?
Just the people. My friend Akusia, I've known for years. Artists that I've met. Various people in social and political positions that I've met. I remember the late President Rollins, who allowed me to actually be a co-pilot on a flight from one end of Ghana to the other end. And so it was amazing.
Are there any upcoming projects or initiatives that you plan to undertake in Ghana?
I have an idea that I'd like to speak on in the very near future that I'd like to do. Obviously, I'm not going to tell you. But I think it would be really a wonderful thing. I think what I'd love to see happen is Africa have an award show and where they can really acknowledge the greatness of people that have done great things in the world.
And that was the great Stevie Wonder. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by James Piper. The producer was Rebecca Wood. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Janat Jalil. Until next time, goodbye.